Hey, it's Doug Gottlieb. What's up? Welcome into All Ball, the All About Basketball podcast, where we talk usually a little bit more than just basketball. Kelvin Sampson, head coach of Houston, just won his 600th game. Competed against him when he was at Oklahoma. I remember when he was at Washington State. Of course, we all remember Indiana. Do you remember Montana Tech? I don't. We'll talk some Montana Tech, some Michigan State. He was a grad assistant there. And, of course, a little bit of Houston, as he'll join us a little bit later on in the show. Should be a little bit later on in the pod. Should be great. So Kelvin Sampson. Also, Kyle Dodd will be our guest. Kyle Dodd's a former point guard at Arizona State. He's their radio color analyst. I want to ask him about I think he was the point guard when Eddie House had 61 points. He was a freshman. Eddie House was a senior. Ask him what that experience is like. And then I want to ask him about the Pac-12. Why is the Pac-12 so down? And I'll kind of give you my own thoughts. Matter of fact, I'll give you my own thoughts right now. I do think that there are certain leagues and certain schools that are not built to be able to withstand the massive turnover. Matter of fact, most programs aren't. Makes Michigan even more remarkable, right? They lose Mo Wagner. You lose Sharif Abdul-Rahman. And up until last weekend, game I called against Wisconsin, they were undefeated. And part of that is Beeline. Part of that is their recruiting, and part of that is the core of the guys that they brought back. And part of that is schedule, right? Some of it is schedule, who you get, when you get them. You played a national championship game. You won a Big Ten tournament the year before. But a lot of programs, like Villanova, wasn't really built to withstand. Had they not lost Dante DiVincenzo and Spellman, they're a top five, top seven team this year anyway. They just are. Duke, obviously, in Kentucky, they have to build themselves to withstand massive losses and defections to the NBA, but they're able to get the top five guys, you know, fight over the top five guys. And you see Ashton Hagans improving remarkably because he's a legit dude. And you see how good Duke is, especially when they have Trey Jones. So you look at the West Coast programs, and from Oregon State losing Drew Eubanks, who put his name in and signed a two-way contract with the Spurs, you know, to Stanford losing Reed Travis, who grad transferred out, to UCLA losing Aaron Holiday, to Arizona losing essentially their entire team. You know, a senior laden, you lose Trey Holder, three big seniors for Arizona State. Like, these programs aren't built to withstand this. USC might have been, but between Benny Boatwright not being right, between Kevin Porter and all the misfires there. But the big thing is, you're judged, a league is judged based upon their elite level, their top level programs. And Cal is a dumpster fire. It should be a better program, but they've been depleted by the NBA and by, you know, Konzo not building it for the long term and then leaving shortly into his stay. And UCLA, I mean, but it's really UCLA and Arizona. And Arizona, because of the accusations midseason last year against Sean Miller, lost most of their recruiting class. And UCLA, you know, it was tenuous at best to see if Alford could keep his job, and they're really young, and they only have one point guard on the team. That's what you're judged by. But we'll get Kyle Dodd's thoughts. Couple thoughts quickly around the NBA. It does feel like Kyrie Irving has decided to walk the walk after talking the talk, doesn't it? Like, single-handedly taking over games, showing the ability to have double digits in assists. It's always interesting when somebody comes out in the media, and I didn't feel like he ripped his teammates. I feel like what he said was like, hey, look, you want to get there? I've been there. I also didn't feel any sort of negative feelings towards him when he said he called LeBron James. Haven't you ever wanted to call somebody in your life and say, hey, you know what? I was an ass then. Sorry. Can you forgive me? I really learned a lot from you. I've done that. I thought Kyrie showed an incredible amount of maturity. And then after the whatever happened in Orlando, taking over games, scoring and assist, he's been magnificent. It's been pretty amazing to watch him walk the walk after talk of the talk. A guy who, for whatever reason, sometimes doesn't get the respect I think he deserves. He's a top 10, maybe top 5 player in the NBA. He is that dynamic. Let me give you a couple other quick NBA thoughts, and then I'll give you some college stuff, some teams that I've seen in person. The Golden State Warriors have added DeMarcus Cousins. And I do look, they're still going to be the overwhelming favorite to win it all. And so when I tweet about DeMarcus Cousins looking heavy and lacking lift and being out of shape, and also how the Warriors are going to have to change the way they play with him, I feel that's a basketball opinion that I have and that is shared by others in the NBA. Whether it's shared by others or not, but it is actually shared by others in the NBA. And here's the thing. Cousins has always been the best or second best player on his team. And now all of a sudden he's going to have to be the fifth best player. Everyone says, oh, I'll be fine. We'll see. And if you play him, even if he gets back to being healthy, and right now he's not fully healthy, he's not fully in shape, he's not moving the same, he doesn't jump the same. Remember, the Golden State Warriors have won 3 championships playing with their death lineup. The death lineup does not have a big guy. And the reason the death lineup works is Draymond can play center and they can switch with everybody with the exception, for the most part, of Steph Curry. If you add DeMarcus Cousins, though it can improve your efficiency on offense and give you another weapon, it also can really hurt you on defense because now you have 2 guys that you're going to try and hide. Right? Now you can't switch with everyone. You have 2 guys you don't really want to switch with. It changes their ball screen cover, changes a lot of how they play. And it doesn't mean that I wouldn't have done the deal if I was the Warriors, considering who else was out there, considering my options. It was a great option, but it doesn't mean that it's a locked up cinch they win a championship. It just doesn't. There's a lot more to it than that. And he's coming off of an Achilles tendon tear, and he doesn't look like he's back the same. Now, can he get back? You got 4 months before he plays in the NBA Finals. There's no reason to believe he won't be better. He won't be further along. An additional concern is he looks a little bit heavy. I would have thought he'd look light coming in, and looking a little bit heavy, that is what tends to have other things get hurt, right? You're like, your Achilles tendon's fine, but now you pull a hammy. And now your knee has soreness, or your hips, or your back, because you're carrying a little bit more weight, and you're not trying to favor your Achilles tendon, but your body's still learning how to adjust and play while you're recovering from what's a debilitating injury. So it's going to be something to watch. I don't think the Warriors bench is nearly what it's been. I know that Livingston's been a mid-range bucket getter and found a way to dig deep in the playoffs before. And Iguodala went healthy, but he wasn't healthy last year. And we'll see if he can dig deep again in the playoffs. So we shall see. But I'm not convinced that they are better demonstrably because of Boogie Cousins. That even though JaVale McGee is not a better player than Boogie Cousins, JaVale McGee knew his role. Block shots, occasionally score. There was one game in the finals where he did have to score. But stay out of the way. Just be a screener, a mover, fly on the wall. And then when he's out of the game, he was fine with it. When DeMarcus is out of the game, how will he handle it? I still think it's going to be fascinating to watch. I also, though, wonder if anybody in the West can beat them. The Rockets aren't as good as they were previously, and Chris Paul, of course, not healthy. Where have I heard that before? The likelihood that Chris Paul is healthy and that they're better than last year's Rockets team beats this year's Warriors team, but last year's Rockets team is no more. Oklahoma City outside of Paul George can't shoot, and something's wrong with Russell Westbrook. I'm not sure that the Lakers, when healthy, aren't the second best team in the West, but they don't have enough shooting. They can guard, really, really guard, but don't have enough shooting. Denver, they're not ready yet. Denver's fun. Denver will be hard to play against because you're playing in altitude and because their center is like a point guard in terms of his ability to pass, and they spread you all out, and they're fun, but they're not beating the Warriors in the playoffs. Portland's come back down to earth, but they're still fun. I don't think the Warriors are as good as they've been. I think whether it's Toronto or Boston coming out of the East, and Boston having trouble kind of adjusting to new roles, but I'm not convinced the Warriors are better than they were last year. The only difference is the West probably isn't as good as it was last year. Let me take a minute to talk to you about Robinhood. Robinhood, you heard of it? No. Robinhood, the investing app. Yeah, Robinhood lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, cryptos, all commission-free. What they want is to make financial services work for everyone, not just for the wealthy. It's a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence. It's simple. It's intuitive. It's got a clear design with data presented with an easy-to-digest way. There's no cost, no commissions. Other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade. Robinhood's web platform lets you view stock collections like the 100 most popular sectors like entertainment and social media and female CEOs, and analysts rate, buy, hold, and sell for every stock. Learn by doing. Learn how to invest and build your portfolio. Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at Doug1.Robinhood.com. That's Doug1.Robinhood.com. Doug1.Robinhood.com. Let me introduce you to Kyle Dodd. Kyle Dodd's a former point guard of mine. I coached him. He played for Brea Olinda High School, played for my dad and me in AAU basketball. He was a freak athlete, a 5'11" white point guard from Orange County who could win any dunk contest, jump to the moon. He was a starting point guard as a freshman at Arizona State. He's now Arizona State's color analyst on radio, and he's been doing it for years, so he knows the entire Pac-12.
All right, let's welcome in Kyle Dodd, who was a superstar, super freak athlete at Arizona State. Best player you played with the Sun Devils?
Eddie House, Ike Diagu, probably are both close. I played with Eddie my freshman year. He was a senior. Just unbelievable scoring games. Just probably my easiest job as a point guard. Just kind of ran the give and go a lot. Give it to Eddie and go the heck away and get out of his way. So Ike Diagu was, you know, phenomenal. He was a freshman when I was a senior, and definitely the best post player I played with. But
it's interesting. Let's start with Eddie. You were the point guard when he scored 61 at Cal, right?
Yeah, that's my claim to fame. Me and Eddie combined for 64 that night. So,
what was it like?
Oh, just incredible. I mean, it was one of those games, and I remember being in the press conference after, and I actually played pretty well that game. And I think a reporter from the Bay Area had asked me, they're like, you know, you guys really have a good on-court rapport and you guys seem to be gelling. And I kind of looked at the guy, which is dumbfounded, like, dude, it ain't that hard what I did tonight. Like, I literally threw the ball as he was getting, you know, ready to shoot. And the thing about Eddie was everybody talks about a quick release and, you know, you get a quick release. Well, what Eddie did is he had quick shot preparation. He got his feet set, so by the time that ball hit his hands, he was in the air almost like Steph does, you know, right now.
Yeah, he was a talker too. Like I talked with him at the game I broadcast last night. I was like, hey, you remember when we played you? It was early on in your career. You got in a fight with somebody like on the sidelines. Like, oh yeah, that shit happened all the time. Like he didn't. It's a different deal, which I'm cool with. Like I would get into arguments with my guys all the time. I don't know how like civilians kind of handle that, but he would talk a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. No, he talked more than anybody I ever played with or played against. My favorite story is we had gone 11 straight years without beating UCLA. ASU hadn't beaten them in 22 straight games. We were playing them at home. It was Eddie's last chance to get them. We were up, I think in the paper the day before, Matt Barnes had said, yeah, we've heard about his scoring game. We've heard about it, but I'm telling you, he has to go for 40 to even have a chance. And we blitzed him. We were up 30 with, like, you know, 5 minutes into the second half, and about 6 minutes left to go in the game, Eddie has 37, gets fouled on a three, goes to the line, and right before he shoots his first free throw, he looks at Matt Barnes, he goes 38, makes it, looks at him again, 39, makes it, and then he just says 40, makes the free throw, checks himself out of the game, looks at our coach, Coach Evans, just says, get me out, and he says, get these dudes off my floor. And I was like, you know, I'm a freshman playing in the Pac-10 for the first time, and I'm like, oh my god, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Okay, Ike Diagu, could he guard different positions? Because it feels like he was like undersized, no neck, but long arms, would be like a 4-5 combo now. I almost feel like he might have been born before his time.
Yeah, I think Ike, you know, he was just raw. I mean, he was really, really talented, but you know, he struggled a little bit to, like, remember plays, you know, defensive assignments and stuff, but just natural raw ability. I mean, he probably fits a little bit better right now in today's game. I mean, dude is still getting it done playing, you know, on the Nigerian national team. But he could step out and shoot it, and the guy had the biggest hands I've ever seen. I mean, I was the GA the next year after I got done playing, and one of my favorite things to do was just run post drills because, I mean, I would throw the ball as hard as I could on a post-entry pass, just to watch him, you know, snag it with one hand, it was ridiculous. But, yeah, very skilled and super good kid, you know, was just extremely educated, at, you know, growing up. His parents were, I think, both doctors and, you know, really, really good kid and smart kid.
All right, last thing. Why is the Pac-12 so bad this year?
I don't know. I just think, you know, so many teams have lost, you know, guys. I mean, I was talking to your brother last night, actually, before the game, and, you know, you look around and nobody has, you know, veteran players anymore. And I think that's why we had a little bit of success early last year, ASU did, because we had three senior guards, and you just don't see that anymore. And I mean, look around the league, and there's nobody in the league that really has players that have been on the roster for 2-3 years. It's all guys that are either transfers or, you know, there's some talent. You know, UCLA, obviously, we see that. I mean, USC, yeah, brought in some talent. I mean, Washington, but I just think it's just a kind of a combination of guys being in and out, coaches being in and out, and, yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's I've never really seen it like this since I've been around it for the, you know, 20-plus years.
We got to run, but my hypothesis is this. One, Arizona, UCLA being down hurts the overall image of the league. But the teams that usually win on talent in the league, right? Cal, the worst they've been in a long time, right? Cal massively down. Arizona had to kind of hit reboot in their whole program. And UCLA firing their coach. Like those three teams, as well as USC and Arizona State, are always kind of up and down programs. But those two, you know, those three are usually talent rich programs, and two of them, complete refresh jobs, and then UCLA just a mishmash where they fired and they don't have enough guards. That's the other part. Dude, good catching up. Appreciate you joining us.
All right, thanks, Doug. Thank you.
Now let's talk with Kelvin Sampson. Kelvin, of course, just won his 600th game as head coach at Oklahoma. And he's had a marvelous career, including leading Oklahoma to the Final Four, where they lost. Remember when Teen Cleaves sprained his ankle, right? The great Hollis Price was his point guard. That was an incredible team. We had seven battles. I think we played them seven times when I was at Oklahoma State. And I think we were 4-3 against them. They swept us my junior year. He beat us on senior night at our place. I believe, a terrific coach. Obviously, the NCAA stuff has distracted people from how hard his teams play and how well his teams play. And then last year, of course, Houston missed free throws. Otherwise, they beat Michigan in the second round of the tournament, and Michigan doesn't go on to a national championship game. Let's welcome in the head coach of the Houston Cougars, Kelvin Sampson. Coach, I know that everybody talks about your team now, and maybe I want to get into last year and how incredible you guys played against Michigan, and kind of how the pain of the tournament is. We don't talk about teams that maybe outperform others because of the result. But let's go back. Okay, your upbringing is different than any other coach in college basketball. Fair?
It is unique.
You kind of took a pause there. You're like, I mean, I can't think of anyone else who's did I read this story correctly? That your dad was part of a group of Native Americans that kind of chased the Ku Klux Klan out of where you grew up, right?
Right, right. They just had I think the 50th year or 60th year anniversary of that. But that was part of the lore of our community growing up. We were right in the middle of Klan country. I mean, I'm sure nobody wants to hear my stories, but I vividly remember some Ku Klux Klan experiences, and we knew what it was, and we knew where not to go. Let's say that.
Well, I mean, you don't have to share any, like, I mean, of the most painful ones, but I mean that. Okay, so you're in Deep Branch, right, which is in North Carolina. So
Pembroke was where I was born and raised. Doug, it's in southeastern North Carolina. The place where the Ku Klux Klan rally was in Maxton, which is about 9 or 10 miles away, and there's always threats. Of their activity, and they were going to go, and you know, everybody knows what the Klan is, but there's nothing positive come out of those experiences. Dragging people out of houses and beating them up, sending messages. They really, really disliked any kind of mixed marriage, so they would target families and send their messages. And. And any time they had a rally, you know, next thing you know, they were busting somebody's door down, dragging people out of the house. This was back in the 50s. This is every time we have Martin Luther King Day, I always think back to like my father. My father was a was inducted in the North Carolina High School Coaches Hall of Fame, but he coached in segregation from 1955 up until 1968. I think was when segregation. Desegregation came to his to the area he coached in, so that was unique. But you know, when you're living in that time, it's not unique to you. It's just the way it was. You know, I remember going to the North Carolina High School Coaches Association clinic, which was a big deal for high school coaches in that state. It was always in Greensboro, North Carolina, and so in 1965, I would have been 10 years old, and I remember going to the clinics, and all the minority coaches sat in one area, and all the white coaches sat in another area. If you were a black coach or a minority coach in North Carolina at that time, that's just the way it was. You know, black kids played against black kids, white kids played against white kids, Native American kids played against Native American kids. But that was normal. But you know, you have those memories, and you know, you're just so appreciative of how far we've come, and I still think we have a long way to go.
So you play at UNC Pembroke, and then you decide, did you pick Michigan State to learn under Judd, or did you pick Michigan State for a different reason?
You know, I took the GRE. I wanted to go to grad school. I wasn't sure where I was going to go. But by being a minority, student, I got to take the GRE for free. That's why I took it. I have a twin sister that was in pharmacy school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And, she told me about it. And I had some friends that, high school buddy of mine played baseball at North Carolina, so I went and stayed with him that weekend. I was playing on the baseball team too. We had a rain out, so I went up there and took the GRE. And if you score a certain number, I have no idea what I scored, but I scored high enough to get put in this thing called a minority locator code, because everybody back then was recruiting diversity. Mm-hmm. So I started getting these letters from all these different schools offering financial assistance to come to school. And that particular spring, Michigan State University was playing Kentucky. I think Kentucky had Kyle Macy. I could be wrong, but I think I'm right. And I just remember this 6'9 point guard from Michigan State. He was a freshman. He had a big old puffball afro, and he was just taking that ball down the court, looking one way, flipping it the other, and it was Magic Johnson. I was sitting there with my dad, and I said, "Can you believe that point guard, 6'9", Dad? I mean, holy smokes! You just never saw that." And lo and behold, within a week or two, I got a letter from Michigan State, and the guy's name on the letter was Dr. Gale Michaels, M-I-K-E-L-S, Dr. Gale Michaels, and he had a number, so I called the number on the letter. He had no idea who I was. He says, "This some kid from North Carolina that we send this form letter to, and he probably thinks it's a personal letter."
Right.
But that guy was so nice and so professional, and that's how I wound up at Michigan State.
What was your first interaction with Judd like? Did your dad call to talk to him?
No. My interaction with Judd was really bad. I was nervous. I was intimidated by him. You could also add scared to death in there, too. You know, I didn't know anybody when I went there.
Take me back. Before you get there, do you remember how you got from North Carolina to Michigan State? I mean, right, this is late 70s. Like, is this bus? Is this plane? Is this train?
I had a ragtop Jeep. And my twin sister went with me. I think she flew back. But she went with me because I was hauling a little U-Haul, one of those little small U-Haul trailers.
Sure.
That you just pull on the back of the Jeep. Going through those mountains in West Virginia, I was really concerned about making it. But once we got there, you know, you just, it's a new place, new people, it's a new experience. But I looked at it as an adventure. I was 22 years old, you know, and what really helped me is I was standing in the dorm, Owen Graduate Hall, with a bunch of graduate students. There was a basketball court right outside the dorm. And so once I got settled, I just went over there and got in a game. And I made friends with this guy named Bob Thompson, who wound up being in my wedding. Bob was from Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan. Really good basketball player, played golf at Valparaiso, was getting his MBA from Michigan State. And he and I hit it off, and he became my basketball buddy. So we'd go out and play hoop every day until it got too cold. But I made my way over to the basketball office. I was teaching three classes, and I was taking 15 credits. I was going to try to get my master's done in 1 year. And so I made my way over to the basketball office, and the assistant coaches was Dave Harshman, Bill Berry, and Dave Harshman, Edgar Wilson, and then you only had two assistants. You know, you had restricted earnings or part-time is what they were called then, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just introduced myself to him and told him I was a grad assistant and asked him, was there any volunteer positions open? And they just kind of laughed at me. I was probably the 50th kid that had walked in the office that day. And so I went back another time, and the secretary's name was Lori, and she was a sweetheart. She was really nice to me. She said, well, what I would recommend is that you go in and talk to Judd. I said, okay. So I set up an appointment, and I walked into Judd's office, Doug, and he goes, what do you want? You know, my confidence level, I finally got my nerve up the door, and my confidence level just fell to the ground. I said, well, I played college basketball at Pembroke State University, which is now UNC Pembroke. And I was wondering if there's something I could do to help out with the basketball team. He looked me in the eye, and he said, no.
Now, Judd, for people who don't know Judd Heathcote, first of all, ridiculously funny, but also ridiculously like stand-up comedian level funny, but also dirty as can be and incredibly sarcastic. So was he being honest or was he being sarcastic?
Honest. He was being honest. And so I said, okay, I got to come up with a different game plan. So I started going over in the afternoons. I teach classes during the morning and the afternoon I'd study, and then a lot of the graduate classes was at night. But I had a block in the afternoon that I could go over to the basketball office, and one of their assistants, I formed a relationship with him, Dave Harshman, who later became my assistant at Washington State. But Dave was really nice to me. I said, you guys have extra work that I could help you with? And so he pulled a chair up by his desk and just, you know, stuffed envelopes, just did secretarial stuff, really. And then he said, have you talked to Judd? I said, yeah. He said, how'd it go? I said, not very good. He said, well, you might have caught him on a bad day. Well, long story short, I go in a second time, and he actually talked to me. And I told him about my father being a high school coach. He liked that. Because Judd, you know, was a high school coach for 14 years in Spokane. So, but he said, no, there's nothing. We don't have anything. And then I found out they had a JV team. And so the third time was the charm, Doug. I went in and said, Judd, is there any way I could be an assistant or help out with the JV team. Because the restricted earnings guy was named Fred Paulson, and Fred was the head coach for the JV team. And the judge said, well, why don't you go talk to Fred? And if Fred says it's okay, then it's okay with me. And that's how I became a grad assistant at Michigan State.
What was he like as a coach? What do you take? Like, everyone knows how funny he was, but he won a national championship. They're an incredible program. What about his coaching was unique?
Judd had the most incredible memory. He put a lot of pressure on the assistant coaches. You better know first and last name. You better know their jersey number. You better have their height and weight accurate. You better have their tendencies. If they were a right-hander, they went left. A left-hander, they went right. He knew everything about every single player. That really resonated with me. He was so smart with scouting reports. He knew how to take away your strength. I remember we played Purdue one year with Joe Barry Carroll. And Judd knew how to, you know, he played a 2-3 matchup zone. Terry Donnelly and Mike Berkovich was up front. Greg Kelser, Jay Vincent, and Irvin was on the back. And then we had this guy come off the bench named Ron Bobo Charles. 6'7" or 6'8", had about a 7'2" wingspan. But Judd knew how to take a man and a half and assign it to the player that he wanted to limit. And he did the same thing with Larry Bird in the national championship game. But just his intelligence, the smartest coach I think I've ever seen. He was so smart, and he was his sense of humor. He could be so sarcastic and tough in practice and say one thing and crack up everybody, coaches, players. But there was such a respect for him. And when he got out of coaching, you know, I think Tom, you know, his exit from Michigan State was what everybody should do. He built a house in Spokane at Manitou Country Club. And when he retired, he moved right to Spokane. He didn't want to be around to have a, you know, a shadow over Tom, which I thought was real professional and classy. But, you know, I could always count on calls from Judd. You know, he'd call and say, hey, tell, you know, he wasn't one of those guys that would like a lot of small talk. After my first year at Montana Tech, the team I inherited, the year before I got there, they were 5-22. My first year, we were 4-23. So Judd calls me up 6 o'clock in the morning. Doug, this is a true story. Hey, Kel, Judd here. I just wanted to let you know that you're the only coach in captivity that possibly could have taken Montana Tech from oblivion to obscurity. Gotta go, Kel.
I want to get to Montana Tech in a second. You mentioned the national championship game. Of course, it's the game that changed college basketball forever. What was it like?
Well, I was a grad assistant. Obviously, I didn't get to travel, but I was there for all the practices. And I was there when they got back. You know, grad assistant under Judd, Doug, was probably right under the senior manager. You know, I was really good at back then they didn't have whiteboards, they had chalkboards. So I was really good at erasing the chalkboards, making sure Judd had chalk. Sometimes I would take assistant cars and get them cleaned out, wash them and vacuum them. And that's the stuff I did, you know, pick up towels. When they get back from road trips, sometimes I'd go meet the managers and help them. You just did that stuff, but the value was just being there and absorbing and learning. You know, and I was like a kid in the candy store. I learned from everybody. You know, Judd always had great assistants. His coaches' meetings were legendary. The practices were so intense. But Judd was so serious. You know, I run my basketball camp today exactly the way Judd ran his basketball camps at Michigan State. He did bed check every night on every kid. He had 3 roll calls a day. He did every roll call. He never missed a minute. He would go to those gyms, and if those referees weren't running back and forth, he'd stop the game and lecture the referees. he was the most. I loved him. I mean, I loved Judd. I loved getting his calls. And last 3 or 4 years of his life, I tried to call him once or twice a month, and I think he appreciated those calls. And he had so many guys in his tree. We just played South Florida Saturday, and me and Brian Gregory before the game, we were talking about Judd.
Magic. For somebody who got to see Magic Johnson at that stage in his life, what was he like?
Hardest working practice player I've ever seen, Doug. Magic had a health class that got over about 1 o'clock. Practice didn't start till 3. Remember the old tossbacks?
Mm-hmm.
You know, those nets that you threw to and it'd throw you back. Magic would take those tossbacks and set them up around the gym. You know, he'd have his green practice jersey over on the side, and he would work out just in an old gray T-shirt. And he would, by the time everybody got to the gym for practice, Magic's T-shirt would be soaking wet. But his favorite drill, and my favorite drill I got from Judd, was 4-on-4 cutthroat. And Judd would use cutthroat to teach certain parts of the game, whether it was post-entry, cuts off the post, ball screens, ball screen defense, whatever he was working on. But he would always give Magic the walk-ons, and he never lost. You know, Greg Kelsey was the 9th pick, I think, by the Detroit Pistons. Jay was in the first-round pick by Dallas. But Magic never lost a cutthroat game. He would make sure his team would win. I mean, he would get on his guys if they weren't playing hard enough. He was the ultimate winner.
He used to, when he played the UCLA men's gym, though, he used to call the worst fouls ever. And it was like, well, it's Magic.
That's part of why he never lost.
You mentioned Montana Tech. You show up there, the team won 5 games, and you mentioned four. But, like, listen, your dad was a coach. You played. You're learning as a GA under one of the all-time great legends. You show up there. What was it? What was your first head coaching experience like?
Well, let's go back. That summer would have been the summer of 1980. Tom Izzo and I were commissioners in Judd's basketball camp. Tom was, you know, Division II guy from Iron Mountain, Michigan, and you know, I got to know. You know, I think Tom might have been a year or two older than I was, but. We're just working camp, and Judd called me in one day and said, "Hey, because I couldn't get a job, and I was finished my master's, and I was actually getting ready to have a fellowship to work on my doctorate." And so I went in and talked to Judd and asked him what did he think I could do. And by this time, I could tell that, you know, you can tell when somebody likes you. Judd liked me for some reason. I think he felt sorry for me, to be honest with you. He said, "Well, what the hell are you going to do with a doctorate? What are you going to do with that?" And he said, "Teach? You can teach without a doctorate." So he said, "Why don't you go get a high school job if you can't get a college job?" And that's the way Judd was. And I was in the process of doing that. And then one day at camp, he came in and said, "You want to go to Montana?" I knew where I had heard of Montana, but I didn't know where it was as far as the map. I had to get a map down. But our restricted earnings coach, Fred Paulson, who was an excellent, excellent coach, got the head job at Montana Tech. And he asked me to go with him as his assistant. So I was 23 years old. I think I turned 24 that October. So this was in August. We go out there. Fred ran into some personal problems. And the school had never had a winning program. Doug, it was a bad job, hard job, bad job. It's an engineering college. Every degree curriculum required a minimum of 30 credits of math. So you can see right away it's a tough job to recruit to. So Fred left in December. The AD, who was about 78 years old, who was part-time, called me in and said, you want to finish the year out? I didn't have any other options. Actually, I was applying for a junior college job. Judd called and told me about a junior college job at Haskell Indian Junior College in Lawrence, Kansas. And I was talking to them about that. Karen and I, we didn't have any kids yet, so you know, we were very mobile. We could move. So I was thinking about going to Lawrence, Kansas, and then this thing popped open, and so I stayed and finished the year, and that was a tough year. You know, it was, we went 4-23. That was tough, but I had great kids. I still keep in touch with some of those guys. One of those guys owns his own oil and gas company over in San Antonio, so he's actually come to some games at University of Houston.
How'd you turn around?
Well, I didn't know how to recruit. I'd never recruited before, and at Montana Tech, is everything's on the phone. You know, I just got all these recruiting services, and I got lucky on some kids. My best players I signed 2 weeks before classes start. Kids that had fallen through the cracks. The vice president at Montana Tech played college basketball at Carroll College. My first year at Montana Tech, the best basketball player in our conference was Bobby Petrino, who was the coach at Louisville.
Wow.
He was the player of the year in football, and he was the player of the year in basketball. He could really play, Doug. Great shooter, tough. He was a great competitor, but he could really play basketball. We just got a bunch of kids and just played hard. We shared the ball. We played hard. And, you know, our games were in the 50s. We couldn't score very good. So he said, well, you guys play slow. No, we just can't score. There's the difference.
You know, what's interesting is you had such incredible success at Wazoo, and at Washington State was a lot like Oklahoma, is a lot like Houston now, where guys that, I don't know, people missed on, or for whatever reason, they weren't. When you got it going at Oklahoma, I mean, Hollis Price obviously was a very highly touted recruit. And in Indiana, even, you were getting highly touted recruits. But it feels like, kind of like you as a coach, you have more success, or maybe, I don't know, you enjoy it more with the guys that have been told no, or the guys that slipped through the cracks, even going back to Montana Tech. Is that a fair assessment to make of a 600 win career, and that you've had a remarkable amount of success and maybe the most success with guys that other people missed on?
The early years, for sure. When I left Washington State, I thought we were right there with Arizona and UCLA that last, because Isaac Fontaine went on to be a 2,000 point scorer. I had him as a freshman. Nate Erman, who got drafted by Utah, was a freshman. Mark Henderson, who got drafted by Philadelphia 76ers, was a sophomore. Then I had two other kids coming in. We were going to be – that's why I was so reluctant to leave Washington State to go to Oklahoma, because I thought we had a chance to win the Pac-10. But I had really, really good players. But to start our first couple years, you're dead on. We had to find kids that just – would lace them up and just flat out get after you, and that became the identity of our programs.
Last thing, to go from where you started to now a 600 win coach, a guy who's been to a Final Four, and look, you know, we don't have time, and nor does is it worth it with the negative energy about the NCAA stuff. But how do you want, when people say Kelvin Sampson 600 win coach, what do you want people to say about you as a coach and about your programs?
Well, I think you know, the people that know you the best is your players. The people that don't know you are the ones that have the most opinions. So they're basing their opinion on what somebody else said. And what somebody else said is not always accurate. You know that as well as I do. I think the thing that I would want to be remembered for was that I always had my players' backs. That I supported them, that I got my greatest satisfaction out of seeing their success, just seeing them improve, just working with them on a couple things, and see them take that thing and become better, and then hearing from them, getting wedding invitations, telling them they had a new baby, I got a new house, I got a new job. Now, I get those calls every day. Literally, 4 or 5 times a week, probably, because you know, when you coach at so many different schools, you have so many former players, and hearing from them is what I enjoy the most. The wins and losses, you know, if you win, you're a good coach. If you lose, let's go get another one. I get that. That's our profession. You know, somebody said you're a bad guy, therefore you're a bad guy. I get that too. But you know, I've always dedicated myself to my players, helping them. And I think that's what I would want to be known for.
I will tell you this. I know your time is crunched. When we played against you guys, and I told you this when you were at Indiana, I hated that matchup zone because we could never seem to figure it out. Your teams screened better than any team I've ever played. I never played against a team that screened as well. Like literally meet like body to body contact. And they just competed. And that's where we didn't like you, but it was a rivalry to which we actually respected you guys because we felt like our players were better. And yet we could never, we split like every series. You swept us 1 year, we swept you 1 year. But I always felt like we're like, we have better players. Why don't we beat them more? But it's because your teams played so hard and so cohesively. And I'm always fascinated by how that's built.
Yeah, I think if you don't have great players, then you've got to find something to be great in. You know, it's like cutting. I think that's something that, I spent 30 minutes yesterday in practice on accelerating through your cuts, just like jump stopping into ball screens. You know, just little things make such a big difference. I read a quote from Martin Luther King that talks about, you know, dreams are big, and you know, small things is what makes such a big difference in somebody's life. That was so apropos, I think, to the way we try to coach our team here, and all our teams. But I remember those Oklahoma State games. I had a chance. We went back there and played this year. I had a chance to see Coach Sutton, and I told my wife. I said, you know what, Karen, as a coach, Doug, when you're coaching a game, you don't always feel the other coach. I always felt Eddie. I always thought he was the best coach that I ever coached against because of the way he prepared his teams. He taught me a lot. I mean, I know I've said this before, but you know, I was 37 years old and I was coming into a great conference. And when your biggest rival has a Hall of Famer and a legend down there, I watched Eddie's teams, you know, and I learned a lot from him. When I was at Washington State, I learned a lot from Ralph Miller. He was the coach at Oregon State when I got there. Those two guys taught me a lot. Judd Heathcote, Ralph Miller, and Eddie Sutton. Those are three great, great coaches to learn from, and I learned a lot from all three of them.
Well, congratulations on the success, on the 600 wins. Here's the 600 more. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
All right, let's turn to college basketball kind of quickly here. And I did get a chance to see Michigan up close. And just a kind of couple quick thoughts on their roster. Obviously, they're built more to play great defense than they are offense. Once Xavier Simpson became their point guard, it changed them forever. Now you put, you know, Xavier Simpson and Charles Matthews and Jordan Poole in a backcourt. And John Teske's a really good rim protector. He's averaging like 2.5 blocks a game. And Brazdeikis is not a bad defender as a freshman. I mean, he's a big physical body. But if he's your worst defender on the floor, like, and you have really well coached, like, that's a good defensive team. And then you also have Livers, and you know they're using Eli Brooks a little bit, so you get a little bit more of a scoring point guard. I thought Austin Davis did a decent job against Wisconsin. What's interesting, look, Brazdeikis is a guy who eventually will probably be an NBA player. I don't think it'll be this year. I think it'll be next year, but he's big enough to be one of these hybrid guys. He's pretty athletic. He's 6'7", 215. Got to be a little bit better shooter. Got to understand shot selection a little more. He and Jordan Poole are fantastic. You know, like people are on to Jordan Poole because he shot so much against Wisconsin. Brazdeikis was in foul trouble and was kind of a no-show. And, you know, Simpson made some shots and made some plays, but he's not a scorer. I'm not convinced they have enough scoring. Matthews is a really good kind of mid-range pull-up guy, but he is not a pure scorer. It's fascinating to see the transformation of John Beilein, his team from being like unguardable in terms of their offense, their movement, their spacing, to being one that has to generate offense off of their defense. And they turned the ball over a bunch against Wisconsin. The one thing about Xavier Simpson, which is interesting, and I experienced a little bit of this, when you get into college and teams stop guarding you and then you make shots and now they are guarding you, you'll lose your finishing shots. He's not a natural scorer in any way. He's a great defensive player. Great defensive player. And, I mean, just tougher than a $2 steak. But he has to learn now how to it's one thing to learn to finish. It's another thing to learn to finish when guys might be playing a little defense on your finishing shots. It's one thing to learn to shoot. He's reworked his shooting form, and he's shooting a reasonable 33%. But now, can you shoot when people are actually guarding you? I still think Michigan State is the best team in the Big Ten. They just went out and thumped Maryland. Cassius Winston's the best point guard. Three best teams, Maryland and Michigan, and Michigan State have the three best point guards. But I think Michigan State, who's the best offense in the league and still pretty good defensively, I think they're the best team. But it's fascinating to see this transformation of Michigan basketball, right? Fascinating to see it go from an offensive juggernaut to one that is really guarding people. And look, they didn't play well. They turned the ball over, I think, 19 times against Wisconsin and had a shot to win it. Had a legit shot to win the game. Last thing is, watching North Carolina against Virginia Tech, and they thumped Virginia Tech, and I know that there have been times in which they haven't played well. But the emergence of Nasir Little, and it's only one game, and it's only one game where he hits two threes, and he only played 20 minutes, but 23 points, six rebounds, three assists in 20 minutes. If you watched him play early in the year, where it felt like it didn't matter how many minutes he played, he was going to get a shot up the first time he touched it, where he's hunting shots more. It's really impressive what Roy Williams has been able to do with him. And I don't know if he's gotten him to buy in, or it's just patience, or it's the kid learning to have patience and improving as a perimeter shooter. But he looks so much more comfortable within what they were trying to do offensively. And like, look, Luke May didn't play poorly, but Luke May just does not have the upside of it. I'm still fascinated to see all the versatility, the different lineups that North Carolina could use. And their offense is much more opened up than it was early on at North Carolina under Roy Williams. And, you know, they were running the same stuff they ran at Kansas. But in terms of being a kind of closing horse and all the freshmen this year, Nasir Little's a guy that is, watch his tape. He's progressively getting closer to what many of the high school recruiting analysts thought he could be. And, you know, playing the four obviously is going to give him a massive mismatch. Carolina's been impressive with how they've improved here as of late. Last thing here I want to share with you on the pod is how, and many of you are coaches or players or whatever, and we've talked before about transferring and why, whether you're against or not. Jordan Tucker transferred from Duke. He only played two games at Duke. Now, had he stuck it out by the end of last season when he transferred, he would have gotten minutes. They needed shooting off the bench, and they probably would have had a better season. But he knew he was coming in, and he didn't think that he was going to get the run. And so he transferred to Butler. And when I talked to LaVall Jordan, he was like, look, the ball comes off his hand just better than everybody else. But I struggle to find minutes for him because, you know, our three starting guards are just so much better defensively. And then, you know, McDermott, who's my starting four man, is really a three. And he's better defensively, may not be the shooter, but he's a very, very good shooter in his own right. Maybe he's a better overall player. And so I struggled to find minutes for him. And this is where you kind of stick it out, and it's a long season, and you buy in if you know you're good enough, and eventually it'll turn your way. I don't know if you paid attention to Butler, but over the past two games, they've played McDermott and Jordan Tucker together. And then it, you know, all of a sudden now, Kamar Baldwin had 30 against St. John's. They combined Tucker and Baldwin for 54 points, and they beat the Johnnies. Now, that doesn't mean all their problems are solved. You know, they're relatively unathletic at center. And they did just beat DePaul, but they beat DePaul by 18 after trailing early in that game. And they beat St. John's, who's probably the most talented veteran team in the league. And now they got Villanova coming up at the time in which I'm recording this. I think they're going to beat Villanova. I could be dead wrong because they struggle at that four spot, guarding anybody and really rebounding. And that's where Villanova will, with Eric Pascal, especially when he's playing the four, will expose you. But it's just interesting to me on how coaches come into the season thinking, you know what I'm going to do? We're going to be a defensive-minded team. We're going to climb into you defensively because we have, you know, we have Aaron Thompson and Henry Badley to go along with Kamar Baldwin, and we'll have the best three guards defending the ball. The problem was, can't score. They just can't score. And, you know, at some point they do award championships or NCAA tournaments to teams that have more points than the opponent. And a little bit of it is, hey, you know what? If you can make shots, they'll find a place for you. But Jordan Tucker is kind of quietly averaging 10.5 points a game in only 19.5 minutes a game. And his production continues to improve. Last three games, all in double figures, 12, 19, 24. I'll be interested to see what he does against Villanova, but I think Butler has figured out who they are. And sometimes it takes you to mid-January, sometimes it takes you to February before you find that out. All right, that's it for All Ball. Again, I encourage you to listen to my radio show, which is daily, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com, or Sirius XM. We're on, what, 217 and 203, right? 217 and 203. Check us out. Make sure you tweet this out, send it to your friend. We really appreciate you listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.